walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and before we go any further, I want to extend my thanks to all who donated in support of Talking Animals during WNF's Summer Fun Drive. The station did fall just a bit short of our overall goal, though we're darn close, so if you didn't have a chance to pledge last week, or even if you did, I'd love to see you visit WNF.org and make a quick donation. $50, $100, more if you can swing it. Either way, thanks again. My guest today is Janet Doner, an author whose specialized books include Farm Dogs and Livestock Gardens, reflecting 35 years of experience on her small family farm. In Doner's new book, The Encyclopedia of Animal Predators, she provides a wealth of information about how to protect livestock and pets from harm by learning to identify threatening species through their habits and habitats. We'll hear all about this new book, how she came to write it, and more when I speak with Jan Doner in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll remember Ray Villadonga, larger than life and enormously important member of the WNF family that we lost to cancer on Saturday. He wasn't just important to WNF, but also to the music community and the community at large, and he played an important role in some major Talking Animals events. More on that later, including hearing some wonderful music made by Ray at one of those events. Right now, though, let's get to Jan Doner so we can learn about predators. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Jan Doner to Talking Animals. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
I'm really well. Thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals today.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Great. So, of course, we'll spend certainly plenty of time discussing the Encyclopedia of Animal Predators, but the new book seems to represent just the latest example of how, as an author, you've kind of carved out a distinctive beat for yourself.
True.
Yeah. So tell me about yourself. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in northern Indiana, and we live here now in southern Michigan. But, yeah, these things are all related. My husband and I moved to the country in the late 70s, like many people in our generation, sort of back to the Earth, right?
Right.
And we very much were trying to carve out a small family farm. It wasn't our primary means of supporting ourselves. But yeah, we did what a lot of people have done. We wanted chickens and sheep and horses and goats and dogs and all those things we moved to the country for. And it was pretty soon after we bought our first little box of chicks, you know, at the feed mill, that we started being visited by raccoons and weasels and things, and we realized it was more than just this bucolic image of a few chickens running around. we were going to have to protect them, too. That was part of our responsibility. And one of the ways that we, besides beefing up our protection of our coop and everything, is I remembered about those breeds of livestock guardian dogs that, you know, I would read about dog books when I was a girl, and the Great Pyrenees is probably the one that comes to most people's minds. You know, the big white fluffy dog that lives with the sheep.
Sure.
And so I bought a puppy, and that was the late 70s when the use of these dogs was just beginning in North America. It's a very old technique, obviously, from Europe and Central Asia, but this was new for us, so we all had a lot to learn. So working with the livestock guardian dogs, working to try to, protect our animals from predators in a coexistence way, you know, it's all related. It ain't much so.
Well, it's funny, even though you really get into kind of the livestock guardian dogs pretty much towards the end of the book, I actually kind of wanted to start there in a way.
Sure.
And I want to come back to that in just one sec, but let's hear a little bit more about the farm first. Like, so what size farm are we talking about?
We only have 10 acres, which is pretty much the size of what I would call like a homestead farm. And it's Michigan. We have rolling pastures and wetlands and a lot of trees and grassland. And right now we're raising a flock of Shetland sheep we've had for about a decade. But we've had horses here, too. We also have goats. And, of course, we still have chickens. We've had them for 40 years.
Yeah.
It's very, you know, much a green, nice, rolling wetland area. But we face most of the same predators people across the United States face. You know, there's coyotes right outside the pasture fence. And there's the little guys, raccoons and possums and things. And the bigger predators are moving down closer to us here in Michigan because their populations are recovering. So we're seeing, you know, a lone mountain lion or a lone bear, or, you know, wolves are probably on their way down as well, and kind of typical for a lot of people throughout the country.
Well, as habitat changes kind of kick in, so goes, I think, a lot of changes for a number of species who are just trying to cope and react and find places to live and be safe and eat.
Absolutely.
And, So, all right. Go ahead.
I was just going to say their ranges are changing. The other thing that's happened is they've gotten used to living close to us, too.
Right.
Because so they've habituated to us, so we're finding them in our backyard, even if you live in the city.
Now, with livestock guardian dogs, I'll confess that some of my original interests, because I've been interested in them for a number of years, my original interest, sadly, perhaps, comes from a series of Looney Tunes cartoons featuring Ralph Wolf and Sam Sheepdog, you know, those animals that would chat and punch the time clock, and then they'd be adversaries, and they'd come back out and go on break or whatever. Something tells me the reality is a little more serious than that. So tell us about real-life livestock guardian dogs, or LGDs, I guess, as people refer to them for short.
I think people here in, you know, in North America are familiar with herding dogs. So when we think of farm dogs, we think of herding dogs.
Yeah.
It's a general sort of all-purpose, you know, farm dog that did a little bit of everything. But in the big sheep and goat cultures everywhere from the Great Pyrenees in France and Spain to northern Italy all the way across, you know, through into Turkey and Central Asia, lots of those people took their sheep and goats into the mountains or into greener pastures in the summer. And those shepherds were with those animals, but they had big livestock guardian dogs with them as well to help protect against predators. And they all share a very similar trait. They're very large dogs, but they have low energy. They sort of save their energy for when they need to do something. And they're all they bond to their stock as well. I mean, they're raised as from the time they're puppies with their sheep or their goats. And they come to see them as part of their pack, sort of, right? And who you need to protect. So learning to work with them has been a different thing for people in North America because that we weren't used to this idea of this animal that lived, you know, 24 hours a day out with their sheep or goats and would most of the time just be occasionally patrolling around and, you know, barking a little bit and stuff, but was there to sort of protect them in the long run. They have low prey drive. They're not interested in chasing things, you know. It's rising to the moment when they need to. But they are protective large dogs. They're not usually dogs that are suitable for life in a suburb somewhere.
They do just kind of hang out amongst the sheep, let's say. And so one of the things that you touched on, I think, in the book, and I just figured since they're not, it seems like at least not having a much human interaction. They're protecting their flock, but not necessarily having much human interaction. One of the things I think you talked about is that depending on how that's handled, there is some opportunities or, I guess, risk even of them going a bit feral.
Well, and that's the wrong way to raise them. It was sort of a misconception that we had here when we started using them because we knew they lived with the sheep, but we didn't realize that, you know, lives of shepherds and their dogs were very intimate together. They lived together, right, or out on pasture together. So the dogs are, you also need to build your relationship with them so that they see you as, you know, their owner, and that you can handle them safely and everything, you know, veterinary care. They need to be groomed. They need to be fed every day. So it's kind of a mistake to think that you could just throw them out in the field and ignore them. And they actually work better if they have that relationship with you. But there is a big difference because if you have a herding dog breed or you have a hunting dog breed, those dogs really want to live in the house with you. They want to be with you. They're like little shadows, right? They're following you around everywhere. And livestock guardian dog breeds are much more independent and self-reliant. You know, they're happy to see you when you wander out there to talk to them and check on them. But then they kind of get back to their own business, and they aren't dependent on that kind of human companionship the way our other dogs are. I have a little English shepherd who's a herding dog, and you know, she follows me from room to room, right? She's glued to you. And livestock guardian dogs are not like that. They're just independent. I wouldn't say they do need human attention and companionship and love and care, but they're just happy to be on their own a lot, too.
In an average, let's say, 24-hour block, how much time does a livestock guardian dog spend with the humans in the equation relative to out there amongst its flock?
Not very much time with the humans. Yeah. I would think most owners are out there once or twice a day. You know, the dog does need to be fed. You need to check them over, be sure that they haven't had an injury or they're feeling well, and, you know, their coat needs some attention and grooming and stuff. But no, most of the time during the day, they're actually sleeping, because most of their work is at night. And that's when they're up, because that's when most of the predators are out prowling around. And you will hear them barking a lot at night. I know some people complain about the barking, but to, you know, me, it's like, well, they're on the job, right? And so they're keeping away what needs to be kept away at night. So you don't have a lot of interaction with them during the day. Farm families and the kids that grew up on a farm and stuff, you know, they can love on that dog as much as they love on their own dog, but they're not bringing it in the house, playing with it in the yard, you know. But if you're out and around in the barn and you're feeding animals and you're doing things, you know, they're going to come over and hang around with you.
Is it kind of just the constitution of a livestock guardian dog that, I mean, most of the dogs that we know, they sleep when they sleep, but these dogs obviously have a certain job to do, as a number of dogs do, but their shift, as you've kind of noted, is at night. So is it just natural for them to do their sleeping during the day and then just be ready all night to sort of guard against the predators that are typically going to come at night?
It's very natural, and they're going to react to the environment that they're in. Some people are using livestock guardian dogs to protect their pastured poultry, for instance. And besides nighttime, you have daytime threats, like hawks and eagles. And so the livestock guard dogs will alert to predatory birds that will fly overhead. So, you know, they're trying to keep one eye open there to watch things. Many people have found out they actually need to have two livestock guard dogs. They can kind of give each other a break, especially if they're like on 24-hour shifts here, and they are in some situations. So one dog can get kind of exhausted and worn out if there's a lot going on.
Right. And also, I think you note in the book that in addition to that, if there are multiple predators that turn up, sometimes that's just too many bodies for just a single livestock guardian dog to fend off.
Absolutely. And we're seeing that situation a lot out west, where you and areas where you might have small groups of coyotes, where you definitely would have packs of wolves, for instance, or something. And, you need more dogs out in a pasture or a range situation where they're going to be confronting, you know, either larger predators or greater numbers of them. Because they would have worked that way in the mountains in the Great Pyrenees, too, you know?
There
would have been several dogs with the shepherd.
Sure. I guess one or two other quick things about livestock guardian dogs. So if people happen to encounter them, how should we behave? What are some basic do's and don'ts? Again, because they're unusual dogs that live unusual lives. So a lot of us that maybe hadn't been exposed to them wouldn't necessarily know, hey, don't do this or don't approach them this way. What are some guidance?
Well, obviously, if you go to a farm and you see them out in a field with sheep or something, you should never enter a pasture or reach through the fence or do anything, because they're going to come up barking towards you because they're protecting their sheep, even if it's during the day. The kind of more problematic encounters seem to be occurring in like open rangeland out west, where people are also bicycling, right, or hiking or something. And ranchers who are out with sheep will post signs at trailheads saying, you know, there are dogs out with sheep, you know, in this area. And the thing is not to approach them, to take a big circle around them. If you're on a bike, get off and walk it around them. And if they seem like they're really worried about you and they're coming up to you barking, you just need to back off and, you know, move away and stuff. Hikers in Europe are actually you know, more comfortable with this, because for a long time they've been encountering these dogs in the Alps or in the Pyrenees or something, and they kind of know the rules of the road, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to walk right up to them. You're not going to be able to pet them, you know?
Right.
And you don't want to, because you're just aggravating them more and they're getting more worried about it.
Right. No, it's just so interesting because, again, if you're just not accustomed to it, and if you approach the farm, I guess you would sort of figure out some things in advance. But for the dog, it's clear that, hey, if you're especially coming in where they are, you're as much a predator as the next thing that they're trying to guard against, I guess.
Right. And, you know, most of them are pretty discerning. You know, they livestock guardian dogs work mostly by just frightening things away. It's more unusual that they would actually have some kind of confrontation even with a predator. And that's the great part about them that makes them good in sort of predator control, that you want to be sort of a coexistence-based sort of predator control.
Gotcha. So livestock guardian dogs have the task, as we've heard, of protecting livestock from predators. But the book is really chiefly about predators. So let's focus on some. Now, you mentioned coyotes a few times, and I think beyond that, and I think the animal's kind of highlighted at the beginning of the book, and I think a lot of people are aware of coyotes, but may not fully understand coyotes and coyote behavior. So maybe let's start with coyotes. Give us the lowdown of how they behave, and are they as ubiquitous as they seem? What should we do about that, whether we have farms or not? Because they seem to be well beyond areas that are strictly farm concerns.
Absolutely. They actually were only found on the Great Plains back when the European colonists, you know, made their way to North America, and Lewis and Clark were the first people to see them, because they were confined to the grassland sort of areas. But combined with the loss of large predators in a lot large parts of the country and the clearing of land for agriculture, coyotes have moved everywhere. They are all across the country, just about everywhere. Chicago, right? City, the South, everywhere. And it's something that has happened in the last few decades as well for certain areas of the country. So they're sort of new to us, you know, like you're saying. And they've habituated to living near us as well. Coyotes are actually, you know, like any other wild animal, you know, they would prefer not to be seen, right? They're usually active sort of dusk to dawn, but they maybe occasionally are out during the daytime as well, especially if, you know, a mom has got pups to feed, right, and stuff, and she's out hunting more. What works really well is to not encourage them at all. And people who live in suburban areas that are starting to see a lot more coyotes around their backyards and their recreation parkland nearby, they're really advised to sort of haze coyotes when they see them. And it just means to be scary and loud and yell at them and don't encourage them in your yards and your neighborhood. And, you know, because you want them, it's just like with bears, you don't want them to habituate and think that it's okay to be in your backyard, right? Looking for, you know, pet food that you might have left out or something. So that's important. The other thing is, with the biologists are really discovering that killing coyotes isn't really the answer, because the more, we don't even have an estimate of the population anymore. It's in the millions now. They're all over the country. The best thing to do is to establish a sort of coexistence relationship with them. If you have good fencing and you're practicing good husbandry of your animals, maybe you have livestock guardian dogs if you need them, you know, they can keep the coyotes on the other side of your fences for years. You know, we've had coyotes raise a litter of pups right outside a back pasture, and our dogs kept barking on our side, and the coyotes taught their pups to stay away out of that field. And then you get this sort of relationship where they stick to their wild side and our farm animals stick to, are safe inside of our fields. And that kind of coexistence is better in the long run. You know, it's just like we are more familiar with this idea that we don't want bears, for instance, to feel at home in our neighborhood or our campgrounds. It's the same thing with coyotes, whether you live on a farm or you're in a suburban area. You don't want them to feel comfortable there, and you want them to stay on, in their territory.
And I guess if you are in a residential area, not sure, a suburban area maybe even, I'm not sure how much you could do. I mean, this reminds me that a couple of days ago, a friend of mine that's on the air here was nice enough, as each week, to announce the guests that I have coming up on Wednesday morning. And another friend who was on the air with him at that time was mentioning that she was walking her dog and saw coyote scat. She lives in St. Petersburg, so, and I assume that she was probably in at the time in a pretty residential area. So I thought that A, that was notable. B, like, I wasn't sure what people living in that area could really do other than just steer clear. And C, big part of the book is you sort of profile all the predators, and it's quite an array, and there's no way we'll get to all of them, but we'll hopefully get to a nice sampling today. But scat is a key element of identifying the animals and being aware of them, and as part of figuring out what you can and can't do, or even if an attack, God forbid, it has happened. So I guess this is a roundabout way of saying maybe we should talk a little bit about scat and its importance, and but also hook it in some way to what, when it comes to an animal like a coyote, what people can do if they're not farmers, they're just living in a suburban area, and yet, as we've talked about, coyotes have really broadened their reach and moved into all kinds of areas that they didn't used to live.
Well, her observation was that one of the important things to do is to be aware of what's going on, right, in your neighborhood. So she observed this cat, now she knows they're around. You know, or you might see tracks or something else. People in suburban areas are actually successful with keeping coyotes out of their neighborhoods if they talk to each other and they share this information, right? And then they all agree that they're going to try to minimize the attractiveness of their neighborhood. And that means things like not leaving pet food out at night in the yard, making sure garbage is securely put away. Coyotes can be attracted to outdoor cooking areas, fish cleaning stations, you know, even your compost if it's uncovered, you know. A lot of these predators are attracted to things in your garden. If you have fallen fruit from a fruit tree or decaying vegetables maybe in your garden. And so this general idea that you're going to keep things tidier, try to keep down rodents that might, they're probably hunting rodents anyway, you know, as their primary food. So if you can try with your neighbors, you know, cooperatively to make it a little less friendly, like people do in bear country, where everybody will use a bear-proof container for their garbage can in a neighborhood. And you can do that with coyotes as well. Actually, a lot of municipalities have little pamphlets that you can get from them about how to cope with coyotes in your neighborhood. And they talk about steps you can all take together, because it's better if you do it together, to try to discourage them, and that you're going to keep each other informed if you see some or you see one. The kind of signs you're looking for is to see a coyote behaving not typically, right? Like not being afraid of you while you're out walking your dog, right? You've more got a problem coyote in your neighborhood, because normally they would run away. Starting to, you know, seem a little, they're hanging around park areas or trail areas or where kids play in a playground or something. That's the kind of thing you have to be alert for, and you might need to talk to your city authorities, you know, about what measures can we take now.
Jana, just seeing an email coming in saying, what about fireworks or bottle rockets as a deterrent to coyotes?
Actually, noisemakers and things that scare them, turning a garden hose on them, if one, you know, is on your property, loud noises like that, just like people do with bears, right? Things like that, we call that hazing. And it sounds like you're being cruel to the wild animal, but really you're trying to keep them from becoming too habituated, because then they will be in danger and the authorities may have to remove them. So it's not a bad, people use bear spray sometimes. They use air horns, same kind of thing, right? Frighten them away. But no, it's not a bad idea.
All right. Well, thanks, emailer, for that question. By the way, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Jan Doner, an author, most recently of the Encyclopedia of Animal Predators. If you'd like to ask Jan a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So, Jan, you've mentioned bears a couple of times, and again, we're never going to get to nearly all the animals that you profile in the Encyclopedia of Animal Predators, but I think it's essential to spend some time exploring bears, in part because many of us, I think, are delighted when we see videos online of bears swimming in someone's pool or recently playing someone's piano even. But I mean, I think that can distract from the fact that they obviously still are, can be quite dangerous, and as you make plain in the book, they are predators. So let's talk first a little bit about black bears.
This is another example of a wild animal species that their numbers are actually greater than when European colonists came here. I'll just think maybe there's a half a million black bears, you know, in North America. Now it's getting close to a million. And they live in smaller areas, but we're coming into contact with them, right? Either recreationally or our sort of, you know, suburban housing is encroaching on them as well. And I think people are really aware that they habituate really easily to living near humans. And those human food sources just become part of their, you know, daily browsing pattern here of how we're going to get dinner. And there are things you can do, again, to make your yard more unfriendly to bears. And it's things like being conscious of bird seed spilling. They're often attracted to bird seed and to the birds that are around there and the little rodents, squirrels, you know, chipmunks, things that might, you know, fall in bird seed. So cleaning up bird seed is really important. Hanging bird feeders up high enough that they can't reach them. And things that we can just do to sort of tighten up the security around our property, you know, to make it a little less. I mean, you have to think even in terms of your landscaping, if you're providing a lot of cover near an area where you know wild animals travel, right? And so if you're, you know, there's bears in the neighborhood and you can pay attention to where they might be moving behind your property or something. If you allow there to be a lot of cover there, you're kind of inviting them in closer, right? So things like that you can do. You can think about fencing in your garden better. There are a lot of conflicts now with beehives because so many people have taken up beekeeping. And it's really true. Bears love their honey, right? Lots of people who normally maybe haven't had a confrontation with a bear are finding that they have to, you know, put a fence around those beehives, put them together in one spot where you can sort of protect them, and think about where you're sort of situating that little bee yard that you're creating, that so it would be away from cover where a bear might come out of or something. So people, yeah, backyard poultry is the same thing. You know, a lot more people are keeping a few chickens in the backyard, but you're also sort of inviting in predators who are drawn to that, you know?
For sure. Well, again, as things shift us and what we do and what our homes are like, not counting the fact, as we already established earlier in this conversation, that a lot of these animals have necessarily had to readjust their habitat and relocate because there's been development or other reasons. So that combination can unwittingly be a real invitation for some of these animals to come visit in a way that's not entirely welcome. So
you really don't want a bear on the back deck, right?
Right. Well, that's the thing. And we see these videos, and I'm sure they represent, relatively speaking, a pretty small percentage of things. But it does just underscore that there's a lot that's drawing those bears, and some are just habituated, which then is its own separate problem, because then it seems like a local agency or authority will step in.
And I think you need to be cautious. I mean, we see, you know, baby animals, whether it's a bobcat kitten or a bear cub or something, and, you know, part of us is like, oh no, maybe it's been, you know, abandoned and we need to save it or something. And you're probably putting yourself more in danger by getting in between the mother and the baby animal as well. You really need to, most of the confrontations, serious confrontations with black bears are because the mother has cubs and she feels like someone's threatening them.
And a lot of times, unfortunately, people don't recognize that at first, and then they're just doing what they're doing or thinking, hey, I'm just out in my yard or whatever, but the mom perceives it as a real threat, and then you got something ugly on your hands.
Correct.
Yeah. So, and also just as a side note, one thing I learned among many other items from reading your book in the bear section was that they're nearsighted, and that that's among the reasons, or maybe the chief reason really, that they often stand on their hind legs to sort of catch the scent of something that their limited vision prevents them from really seeing otherwise.
And we sort of perceive that as a threat, too.
Yeah, well, it's often a threat. And then sometimes, again, you see some of these bears that are up on their feet, and the anthropomorphizing is mixed bag, obviously, in certain situations,
right,
including this one. But you see a bear walking around like a human, you think, okay, this is sort of striking, and some people find it enchanting. But yeah, other people, depending on their proximity, find it quite threatening.
Actually, you know, the other thing that's happening is hikers were conscious of the fact you should make noise when you're out in bear country hiking, right?
Yeah.
We're seeing more interactions that the person is surprised, because people are out jogging now or riding bikes out on trail, and they're going much faster than a person walking, and they're usually silent and much quieter. and they go around a curve, and there's the bear minding their own business, but suddenly you've got this, you know, interaction suddenly happening.
Yeah.
A lot of biologists, you know, really, people have to take their earbuds out of their ears.
Right.
If you're jogging or biking, because you need to be listening and making noise and not, you know, surprising a wild animal. Like,
and probably a good time to put your phone away for the duration of the hike as well. But so again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Jan Doner, whose new book is The Encyclopedia of Animal Predators. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So, Jan, we have maybe just a few minutes left, maybe, and so we'll come back to some other animals as time permits. But one question I had is, in some notes about you that I've seen, you're described as a librarian and researcher. In the course of researching this book, what were two or three of the biggest surprises you uncovered about these animals?
Probably the fact that they're not native to a lot of areas of our country that we think they are.
Yeah. What would be an example that seems prominent?
You know, like raccoons. Raccoons were only found in the southeastern states, down in riverlands, and now they're everywhere, right?
Yeah.
The fact that coyotes were really only a Great Plains animal, now they're everywhere. But the list goes on and on. Bobcats, foxes, possums. Things are spreading out or having more and more confrontations. My husband grew up on a small farm in Indiana, and they raised all kinds of animals and barely saw a predator. But this was the 50s and early 60s, probably the real low point of a lot of biodiversity at this point. And he goes, we never had to worry about a coyote getting the chickens. This has been a rapid change for a lot of us, and I think that's what has been sort of unnerving and sometimes frightening. I think the thing I learned the most in writing the book is that the more knowledge we have, the less afraid we will be. If we're prepared to run across these animals in our neighborhoods or when we're out, you know, having fun recreationally and stuff, then it's not a fear thing as much you're prepared for it. The way I've always felt about predator control on my own farm is like, so much better to build the good chicken coop from the start.
Right.
Build a good fence from the start, because your stress level is so much less if you've set things up that you and the wildlife can coexist better.
It's preventative at that point rather than reacting, reactive. Right. Well, and also, too, one of the things that there's a number of sections, all kinds of animals, and in each section you really do describe the animal, describe their habitat and behavior, and then what kind of the human interaction is like. And again, there's other information in most sections, including what kind of animals they would typically try to prey on and how they would kill, especially because I guess that's mostly designed for if an animal of yours, especially hopefully more farm-oriented than regular resident, but gets attacked or worse, killed, that you can use this kind of information to help decipher what animal likely attacked, if you don't know, if you didn't witness it, which obviously in most cases people don't. And then, of course, the scat, which we've talked about. But there's also interesting things that people get sort of confused about, like, because you do describe, like, if you happen to have come face to face with some of these animals, like, don't run because that triggers their prey drive, their prey instinct.
Correct.
And but some you're saying, you know, back away, and then it's just the source of a zillion stand-up comedy routines. But then with certain bears, there's the play dead thing and when and how that works. But I mean, the thing is, it does get, I think, a little bit tricky to keep that all in mind, especially if you're in a sort of a panicked situation. So is there a general rule of thumb when you would encounter one of these animals that maybe not be that happy to see? And again, like you say, you might have come around the corner and surprise
right.
an animal. So is there just generally a method that people should sort of keep in mind, and knowing that there's
right.
some variation here and there, but basically what should we do?
Basically, you want to stop. If you have small children with you, you need to pick them up or put them behind you or something. You want to make yourself look bigger. And that's why, Forest Service people will say, make yourself bigger. If you have a jacket, wave it, make it bigger. Raise your arms. If you have a walking stick, raise it. You want to look bigger, and so you're not something. But then you should be quietly backing away as
yeah.
well if you can, you know. Picking children up is really important. Children make, you know, loud little screeching noises, and they run, do things that alarm the wild animal or make them think of prey, right?
Sure.
So picking up a child to control them and trying to look bigger and making noise, and, you know, if you know you're going to be somewhere where there are large predators, or you regularly might see coyotes if you're out trail walking with your dog or something, you know, carrying an air horn, even carrying bear spray is not a bad idea, because bear spray works wonderfully, and you can use it when you're 30, 40 feet away from an animal. And in most cases, that will be enough, you know,
yeah,
to have them back off. So, and if you're kind of have thought about these things, a lot of experts I talked to said it's really important to teach your children about wild animals and what's the appropriate way to behave around a wild animal as well. And it's just like we try to teach them how to properly approach, you know, dogs or something.
Sure.
And it's not to be afraid. It's just to understand that in their world, you know what your actions mean.
You have to think like they think and be sure not to inadvertently trigger something ugly that could have been avoided.
Sure.
Yeah. Cool. Well, Jan, we are unfortunately out of time, but it's been really fun and fascinating to talk to you. This is Jan Doner. Her author name on the book is Janet Borwald Doner, and the newest book is The Encyclopedia of Animal Predators, and presumably available wherever people get their books. And Jan, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Oh, thanks, Duncan. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Bye-bye. In a few moments, I'll speak about our much-beloved Ray Villadonga, who lost last weekend, and we'll hear some animal music he made while contributing to a Talking Animals event. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece from Sarah Silverman with an important revelation about squirrels. This is Sarah Silverman with a piece I have chosen to call simply Squirrels in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
So, the truth is I have gotten into squirrels, and now I'm going to get you into squirrels. I'm not kidding. Wait until you see. I learned a fun fact about squirrels that I'm so excited to tell you. Okay, this is what it is. It's this. Squirrels cannot find 80% of the nuts they hide. Is that the greatest thing you've ever heard in your life? First of all, animals aren't supposed to make mistakes. But secondly, I made this realization that is going to blow... Hold your skulls in, because your brains are going to f***ing explode. That's how trees are planted. Are you... planted, God or the universe or nature or whatever the created this anxiety-ridden, paranoid cokehead that thinks that everybody wants their acorns. Nobody wants your acorns. No one else in the world eats acorns, only you. That they hide them everywhere, and then they're so on coke. They can only find 2 out of every 10. Squirrels plant trees in Israel. Right. That I added. That's not true. I added that.
That was Sarah Silverman with a piece I'm calling Squirrels, taken from her new Netflix special, A Speck of Dust. Now a few words about Ray Villadonga. They certainly broke the mold when they made Ray, so we are breaking format today to remember him. Ray Villadonga was a sunny force of nature. I didn't know him anywhere near as well as many who posted about him on Facebook or discussed him in newspaper articles or remembered him on air the last few days. But Ray didn't do anything by half measures, so if he knew you a little, it appeared he liked you a lot. Big greetings. What's happening, bro? Big smiles, big hugs. In Ray's orbit, there was no such thing as a stranger, just someone who a minute later would be a new friend. That irresistible personality and his keen influence reached far and wide, in part because for some 30 years he was host of Step Outside right here on WMNF, introducing devoted adventurous listeners to strange and beautiful music of various stripes. Step Outside currently airs Wednesdays from 8 to 10. Tonight's program will serve as a tribute to Ray. Ray was also a phenomenal musician, chiefly a wildly accomplished bassist who led various bands and played in many others, sometimes spur of the moment. And if you're working on something involving live music, Ray wanted to be involved, wanted to volunteer his services. I'd barely announce a sprawling event like the Talking Animals Festival or a much smaller one like the Talking Animals Music Night, and I'd hear immediately from Ray saying one of his bands in those days, Rayzilla's PBS, would be happy to perform. And perform they did. Here's Ray and Rayzilla's PBS performance on the second Talking Animals Festival at the Lowry Park Band Shell in 2011. As with all Talking Animals events, the music involved animal songs. This is Banchuco Galaxy rolling directly into a song that will serve as today's Name That Animal tune. Here's Rayzilla's PBS, led by the late, truly great, Ray Villadonga. Rest in peace, Ray.
Had a companion for about 16 years. He was short and hairy, and sometimes he smelled bad. He was my dog. Not sure what he was, but he was a dog. Hey, look at Rio there. Hey, Rio. His name was Banchuco, and this is the ode to Banchuco.
Try it. We need all the dog owners to pay attention. Doggies, this is your chance to shine. Sing along with me.
I say so myself. And Banchuco said, let me live my life in peace. I'm death blind and diseased, but the fleas won't let me be. They bite the caca out of me. They won't leave me alone. They bite right through to my bone. No, that just won't let me be. They bite the caca out of me. Oh, but you cool galaxy.
Ray Zilla's PBS, fronted by the late, great Ray Villandonga. And we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity. Kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lillet. Then at 1 p.m., Craig Kopp presides over executive session. Rolling right into Scott Elliott with more great music for the rest of the afternoon. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. Speak again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.